As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Welcome to the Athletic Football Tactics Podcast, and thank you for choosing to listen to us today. I'm Ali Maxwell, and at this stage of the season, more than any, with big honours still up for grabs, you do not rotate your squad, no matter how exhausted they might be. So, Michael Cox and Mark Carey from The Athletic, they've been through their pre-podcast superstitions and routines. They're ready for kickoff. How's things, Mark?
Good, thanks, yeah. Thank you, Ali. Yeah, just 10 days left, I think, if we include the Champions League, 11 days if we include the Championship playoff final. So definitely the home straight now.
Eurovision's Michael Cox joins us as well. Hello, Michael.
Hi, I'm interested to know that I should have some superstitions and routines. I think mine is just frantically trying to find my headphones about 2 minutes before the podcast starts. But yeah, that is what I'm accustomed to. So yeah, I'm in the mood for it.
Whatever helps you settle the nerves and focus the mind, and you've got your first touch out of the way early and you didn't give the ball away. So last week, the Premier League's Manager of the Season shortlist was announced. Five names on it: Pep Guardiola of Manchester City, Jurgen Klopp of Liverpool, Thomas Frank of Brentford, Eddie Howe, Newcastle United's manager, and Patrick Vieira of Crystal Palace. So five on the shortlist. We want to dissect it. We'd like to try and assess managerial performance in the Premier League this season, which actually feels maybe more difficult this season than in previous years. We'll get into why that might be. Worthy of discussion, certainly. We're going to run through some of the names involved and some that might perhaps feel a little hard done by. But like all good pods, I'm kicking off with a quiz question for Mark and Michael. And the question is, I'll start the question with a statement, a fact. The Premier League Manager of the Season award has been won by the manager that won the title 7 years in a row. Who was the last manager to win Premier League Manager of the Season without winning the league?
See, I know the answer to this, and I was going to give it to you as a quiz. So I can't really answer this question. I could have lied and just made myself look clever by knowing off the top of my head. But I was very surprised to see this name. And I think even if you gave people the name, I don't know if they'd get the club.
I couldn't agree more.
Ooh. You're both going to have to put me out of my misery then.
Mark, the manager of the year without winning the title, the last one was Tony Pulis. And it was not as manager of Stoke City. It was not as manager of West Bromwich Albion. It was manager of Crystal Palace after they finished 11th, Michael. You're our pod Premier League historian. What happened there?
Well, it was quite a good performance, in fairness. I mean, Palace were not a side that were accustomed to staying in the Premier League. So he did a very good job to stabilise them and keep them up. And it was quite odd that he departed, I think, on the first day of the next season or just before the start of the next season. Hmm. But yeah, it's a funny one. I mean, 13-14, you think, I mean, Pellegrini won the league with City. And Brendan Rodgers did a really good job to get Liverpool to the brink of the title. I know they kind of blew it at the end, but that was a big overperformance. So, yeah, it's interesting. And the one before that was Alan Pardew 2 years beforehand at Newcastle, who, again, no question, absolutely overperformed. But it is interesting that, yeah, 7 years in a row it's gone to the title winner. I think a couple of them you can't really argue with. Ranieri, Conte, Klopp certainly, Guardiola at least once. But it is interesting that it constantly goes to the... I almost feel like they should be exempt from winning this. You know, you've got your title winner's medal. Let's give it to someone else for a bit of a change, you know?
Well, maybe we could do that ourselves, a sort of alternative award, if you will. Of course, most likely to win it this year, I would suggest, is the manager that wins the title. Let's kick off with Klopp and Pep Guardiola, who are on the shortlist. We've spoken so much about these two teams and these managers recently. And of course, if City beat Villa this weekend, they'll win the Premier League with 93 points. That would be 7 more than they got last season, 7 points less than the 100 points they achieved in the 2017-18 season. They'll be on a goal difference, if they win, of plus 73 or better. And 4 goals they are off 100 with a game to go, having conceded only 24. Firstly, I want to ask you, if Liverpool are to finish second behind Manchester City, before you even consider the rest of the names on the shortlist, surely you can't give Klopp the award over Pep Guardiola, Mark, although I'm sure you'd like to see him win it.
That is true. I would kind of agree with that. I mean, evidence suggests in the past 7 years that would be the case. I think if it is the Premier League manager of the season, which of course it is, then you couldn't maybe give it to someone who finishes second over first when you're looking just at second and first, I think. I mean, the wider picture of Liverpool potentially winning 3 cup competitions, then it, you know, a wider conversation, then yeah, maybe you would maybe give it to Klopp over Pep. But for, yeah, Premier League only, before then getting into the other managers that we'll come on to, I think it would be a little bit incongruous to give it to a manager who finishes just shy of first.
I'm actually not sure I agree. I think for me, manager of the year, manager of the season, it's about overperforming compared to the quality in your squad and overperforming expectations. And I go back to the start of the campaign, and Omar Chowdhury, who's been on this podcast before, keeps tally of Sporting Index's points predictions, i.e. what the betting markets are saying for how many points each team are going to get at the end of the campaign. And when you go back to the start of the year, Manchester City were predicted to get 87 points. Liverpool, along with Chelsea, were predicted to get 77. And so even if Liverpool were to finish, it's probably going to be a point shy of City. I still think there's an argument that Klopp has overperformed by a greater margin than Guardiola, who of course has done a very good job. But I think it's quite possible for Liverpool to finish 1 point short and still say that Klopp's done the better job of the two.
It's a funny one, Michael, because I do get what you're saying, but I always think with awards, whether it's player of the season, manager of the season, team of the year, it's quite difficult to drill down into any sort of context like that and try and explain things like that when you're giving out the award. People really do have little interest in the deeper context, but behind these things, I think, overall.
I agree, but on a 45-minute podcast about it, I'm prepared to say this view, whereas I might not if I was at the Football of the Year awards dinner with them all sitting in front of me in the front row.
Well, when it comes to Pep Guardiola, I suppose the case against him specifically is presumably a mixture of basically voter fatigue, the fact that he's won 3 of the last 4 awards and he is pretty established now as being the best manager around, one of the best managers in the world. And then also the sort of classic line that gets trotted out to diminish the achievements of Guardiola and Man City, which is, well, they've spent a load of money and they have the best squad. So, you know, he's only really on a par with expectation. What's your stance on that, Michael? Because if you followed that line of thinking, he'd never win any awards.
Yeah, that is true. No, I mean, I think he's done a really good job. I don't think there's any question about that. I think when you look at the level that they've played at and the fact that, you know, I know it's almost a boring thing to say now, but City don't have an established centre forward. The 3 players who've got double figures are De Bruyne, Sterling and Mahrez. And I think almost any other manager in the Premier League would struggle massively without anyone really to play through the middle. So yeah, he's done a brilliant job and I certainly wouldn't have any complaints if he won it. But I do think it's possible to think back to pre-season expectations and think about Liverpool. I mean, how bad they were last year, really. I know a lot of that was because of the absence of centre-backs, but there was big question marks about various areas of the team. I mean, someone like Mane was really not on form this time last year. I think Salah's gone to a new level this season. He's integrated Diaz very well. Mane's shifted position. Diego Jota's been used very well. Thiago's come on. There's so many reasons why Liverpool, I think, have, well, using the figures I mentioned earlier from Omar, who keeps tab of these things, probably going to be finishing, what, 15 points ahead of where they're expected. And I think that's a huge overperformance.
Yeah, I do think that that expectation versus reality methodology is definitely a worthwhile exercise and probably should be considered more, kind of as you say, in looking at the manager of the season. I think with the Pep Guardiola thing, I think that it's almost not his fault that he's been so good as a manager over a long period. It kind of comes back to the thing you said, Ali, with the voter fatigue. But I actually spoke with Daniel Taylor, one of our senior writers at The Athletic this week, and he's doing a piece that's coming out quite soon about the influence of Guardiola and his influence not just over the Premier League, but of course over the whole of English football. And he spoke with people, I believe, from teams like Gateshead and Bolton and Dorking, going all the way sort of down the leagues, and highlighted just how much their football has evolved at all levels of football, and how much they're almost trying to be a bit more of a Pep Guardiola side, and things like more passes within a sequence of play, playing out from the back more, a lot, or some, to some degree, less long ball football. And I think it's just interesting to think about it in the wider context of Pep Guardiola's influence sort of transcending Manchester City or even the Premier League, but across the whole of English football, which I know has been a narrative that's been around for a while, but maybe even looking to quantify that would be really interesting.
I can't believe he managed to get a hold of Surrey Senior Cup champions Dorking after their huge success on Tuesday night at the hands of Kingstonian on penalties. I'm looking forward to reading that piece, that's for sure. Let's take a look at some of the other names on the shortlist. One of the things that makes measuring manager performance, measuring team performance difficult is a lack of ability to assess budgets, wage budgets, accurately and in real time. Having said that, we can normally make a fairly educated guess at what playing budgets are across the Premier League. And as such, do we think Thomas Frank of Brentford, who's on the shortlist, if this was a pound for pound award, would probably take the gong?
Yeah, I certainly think so. I think he's right up there. I've been looking into this a little bit more closely. And as you say, there's no real kind of silver bullet to looking at kind of value of squad because there's so many factors to consider. But I saw an interesting post on Twitter recently from Kieran Maguire, who is obviously well known within the financial side of football, very well respected. And he sort of showed that Brentford have the second lowest squad cost and the lowest wage bill in the Premier League. So second only to Norwich, which was really interesting. And again, it shows just how well they've done considering the cost of the squad. And I saw something else by a Business of Football writer called Dave Powell, and he looked at the Premier League spend per point. So looked at the cost of assembling the squad through transfer fees and things like that, and showed, and this was showed by the most recent kind of club accounts, and Brentford's spend per point. So how many millions of pounds were sort of spent, yeah, to earn a point. And Brentford only spend £1.5 million per point, and that is the lowest in the league. So essentially, yeah, what sort of value you're getting from your squad and the cost of that squad is the most efficient from the perspective of Brentford and Thomas Frank, which again kind of goes with what we know to be true, but again very much backed up by the numbers. So pound for pound, I absolutely agree.
One of the things in his favour as well is that the lack of Premier League experience in his squad, of the 11 most used players for Brentford this season, which doesn't include Christian Eriksen, whose signing has been transformative for them, of course, but only joined in January. You know, none of the most 11 used Brentford players this season had any Premier League experience, apart from Sergi Canos, and who can forget his 9 minutes off the bench for Liverpool against West Brom on final day in 2016 before leaving the club on loan. The squad actually had more non-league experience by some distance than Premier League experience, which is amazing, really. And only one of those 11 most used players was signed this summer. So it's not like they spent all summer splashing the Premier League cash. They did so with some savvy, as is to be expected from them. 10 of those 11 played for Frank last season in promotion from the Championship. Michael, what's impressed you most about Thomas Frank's management?
I just think his general demeanour has been quite good. I know that's a bit of a woolly thing to say, but I think for a club like you say, who could have felt out of place in the Premier League, there's never really been a hint of that. Obviously, they started very well with that win over Arsenal, and I think that gave them a big launch pad for the rest of the campaign. I think it's worth pointing out that they really did struggle start of this calendar year. They weren't in a good situation. I was at the game in late February when they lost at home to Newcastle 2-0, got an early red card and were outplayed, really. And I thought that was I thought it was going to be the end for them, really. I thought they were going to go down at that point. And if I'm being honest, I thought they'd go down before the start of the season. But they made a big change for that game. They switched from 3-5-2, which they'd used, I think, in every game up to that point. Went 4-3-3. Obviously, for that game, it wasn't relevant because they went down to 10 men really early. But that change, I think, has really kept them up. And they've got 7 wins since that point. Obviously, the signing of Christian Eriksen has made a massive difference. But yeah, overall, I think they've done really well. What I thought would happen, I mean, it's been obvious for a few years that Brentford are a club on the rise. What I thought would happen was they'd come up, they'd get the money, they'd go down with the parachute payments, and they'd come up again and make a stronger go of it second time round, a little bit like what Burnley did a few years ago, and really, I think, what Norwich were trying to do. But obviously, they haven't needed that. It's been really impressive. And I think a really good story for the Premier League that they've been able to survive, as you say, Mark, in comparison to some much richer clubs around them.
Yeah, I agree on the demeanour point. I think it is very much backed up by... It's not by chance that they are the way they are. I think that psychology is quite key to sort of how they operate. I think that I think Thomas Frank basically gave every squad player a book by Daniel Kahneman, who's an economist and psychologist, to make sure that they read it and approach the game in a very considered way. And I think that they have, Jay Harris wrote a really interesting piece back in October about this, about their 24-hour rule, where they're sort of not allowed to get too high or too low about anything other than the 24 hours following the result. And I think the only exception to that, I think from speaking to Jay, was the Chelsea result going back a few weeks. But it just shows that psychology, not getting too high or low, is very much key. And I think another thing from Chang to Jay was just how aggressive Thomas Frank has been with his substitutions. And Michael mentioned it about how sort of he can change tactically, obviously between games and within games. And Jay wrote a great piece about that from the Everton game going back a couple of days, of how much he, when Everton were down to 10 men, he brought on Vitaly Janel for Mads Beck Sorensen at half time and put another midfielder, Christian Norgaard, also came into the defence and had essentially two midfielders in the back line so they could have more of the ball and build. And ultimately, it worked to great effect, because when the opposition goes down to 10 men, it's not always easy to break them down. And I think he's very considered and has a really clear idea of which substitutions he's going to make depending on the game state and the outcomes that come. And I think that's probably commonplace amongst a lot of Premier League managers, but it also just shows just how astute he is right at the top level. So it's, the psychological aspect, but a real tactical aspect is a real strength of his as well.
Very impressive managerial campaign. This is the Athletic Football Tactics podcast, and in part two, we're two more managers on the shortlist, Eddie Howe and Newcastle. How has he done it? And Patrick Vieira of Crystal Palace, before touching on some of the managers that weren't nominated and might feel hard done by. That's next.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Okay, let's talk Newcastle United and their remarkable rise up the table under Eddie Howe, who joined in November after 11 Premier League games had been played. He's obviously included in the shortlist, so the Premier League don't have any issue with this. But Michael, is there any particular reason you think why someone that hasn't managed for the whole season shouldn't be eligible for an award that covers the whole season? Any issues there?
I don't think they shouldn't be eligible, but I think they're slightly less eligible. I think... 71%, I think, Howe has been in charge of the Premier League season 4. So I think he's 71% eligible for this award.
Well, it's a bit like, I think everyone agrees, let's say when you're looking at team of the season or player of the season, there should be a minutes played threshold that you should have had to play a certain amount of the season in order to be considered one of the best players for a whole campaign. So I'd like you to set a threshold for games managed or percentage of the season managed for a manager to be part of this shortlist. 50%, does that feel too high, too low, maybe?
I'd go 60. I think about 6. I think, yeah, the majority. I don't know. What do you think, Mark?
I think that definitely more than 50, because you have to have played each team once, I think, at least. Ooh. So maybe 2/3, so 66, maybe, if I was being specific.
Okay, so about 23, 24 games, you guys reckon. How will finish having managed 27 games, so he's over the threshold. We're happy with that. Michael, since he joined, only the Big Six, which is also the current top six, have picked up more points than Newcastle. And of the other 14, as they might be called, he's picked up 6 more points than anyone else in that time. What has worked so well for Eddie Howe and Newcastle?
A bit of everything, really. I think they've improved in so many aspects. Obviously, they have signed new players after the takeover. I think that's been a factor. Those players have contributed intermittently, I would say. Wood hasn't really scored goals. Trippier scored a couple of crucial goals, then was out injured. Guimaraes has been excellent in recent weeks, but I think their improvement probably came after he was a regular in the team. I actually think Matt Target's been a really good signing at left back. A weird one, because I don't think, I mean, his performances at Villa were very good. Villa just decided to upgrade with Luca Dean, but Target, yeah, I think was an excellent pickup for them. But, I mean, everything's improved. I think when you listen to the players, clearly just the training sessions are better. They're more intense, they're more structured, they're more tailored towards their challenges at the weekend. And on the pitch, their pressing has improved a lot. I mean, that certainly wasn't a feature of their game under Steve Bruce, but you look at the way they played against Arsenal. I mean, they basically, not just in terms of being superior tactically, but I think their pressing just rattled Arsenal, really. I think Arsenal are quite scared to try and play through it. And with the ball, they've got better as well. I've particularly liked the triangles and wide areas. I think between the fullbacks, the wide players and the number eights, I think that works really well. I know there's been a lot said about Joe Ellington and his new number eight role, but I think it's almost not a number eight role. He's given such freedom to advance both forward and out wide. It's almost like the free eights that we talked about with Kevin De Bruyne and David Silva in Guardiola's first couple of seasons. So I think almost everything has improved about Newcastle, to be honest. And you have to think that, you know, if there's more money invested in the summer, then there'll be another improvement. And I mean, they've almost turned the top six into a big seven based upon the second half of the campaign. And I think that's probably what will happen next season for the whole campaign.
It's amazing how the narratives around managers can change so dramatically, right? Because Howe had a great stint with Bournemouth in the Premier League. You have to say, overall, a fabulous achievement staying in the division for as long as they did. But after relegation, you know, there can be a bit of revisionism. There can be a lot of, well, he was good enough for Bournemouth, but could he take a bigger job at the level? You know, at the peak of his sort of stock, he was being talked of as a future England manager, but it felt like perhaps never being truly believed in when it came to managing in the top half or the top six of the Premier League. But after 3 or 4 months of this job at Newcastle and the momentum that they have behind them, the narrative changes hugely, doesn't it, when it comes to Eddie Howe or a manager like him?
Yeah, I think it does, because, I mean, he clearly did a pretty good job at Bournemouth, but it's tough to know how good a manager is when really they've only done it at one club. I know he had that brief stint at Burnley that didn't really work out, but because Bournemouth, it's a little bit like Brentford, they were on an upward curve anyway, and sometimes you wonder how much the manager is responsible for that and how much he's just riding the wave. But I think now that he's gone to Newcastle, and okay, there's other factors there with the takeover, with the new players, but he has changed them. He's changed them for the better. And so, yeah, I don't think there can be much doubt now that he is a very good manager.
Mark, one thing that stood out to me looking at Newcastle's record under Howe is that it's an impressive points return, 41 from 26 games, but a -7 goal difference, which seemed a little peculiar. Can you take a look under the hood for me and sort of work out what's going on here and maybe how strong those underlying numbers are?
Yeah, I think with the goal difference especially, I think it's maybe a little bit influenced by the fact that they've had a couple of hidings along the way. They've done well largely overall, but they lost 4-0 to Leicester, 4-0 to Manchester City, 5-1 to Tottenham, and 5-0 to Manchester City on a second occasion. So, you know, when you think about things like goal difference, that can be quite heavily skewed by specific results where they only lose 3 points, or they don't gain any points from those games. But, you know, that was a massive skew from those games against the top side. So I think when you look at the games around the side sort of closer to them, they've largely kept it to one goal conceded or a clean sheet at times. I think within that list of 26 games, eight of those were clean sheets, which you think of that in seasons gone by, that would have been unheard of for Newcastle. So going a little bit further, looking at the quality of chances that they've conceded, it's been only more than one goal in terms of expected goals against on 13 occasions. So half of those 26 games, which doesn't sound too great, but again, considering where they were last season and the season before, they've certainly sharpened things up at the back. So I think with the goal difference and how skewed that is, I think it's more just to do with a select few games where they've had a hiding, but they were going to lose anyway, so they've not gained anything or lost too much.
I feel like ever since the takeover, the sort of footballing discussions about Newcastle and their future, the most interesting aspect of it to me is what's the ceiling for this team? Is there no ceiling? Could they be, with such financial backing, challenging at the very top table of English football, like Manchester City, like Chelsea, have achieved since their own takeovers? Or is there something of a ceiling for them in the short term, at least? Well, the way that they're playing under Eddie Howe, I feel, has gone some way to answering some of those questions anyway. And the excitement ahead of next season will be huge amongst the fan base. The last name on the shortlist is Patrick Vieira, Crystal Palace. Now, Palace last season under Roy Hodgson picked up 44 points, scoring 41, conceding 66 for a minus 15 goal difference. This time out, they're on 45 points, 1 point more with two games still to play, having scored 47 goals and conceded only 43, a plus 4 goal difference. So clearly, from the most obvious numbers, Mark, a very successful managerial change on the pitch. Can the underlying numbers back that up and show the exact nature of the improvement under Patrick Vieira?
Yeah, I think this is an interesting one because Crystal Palace have just changed so dramatically in their style. So even looking at points and numbers like you gave, it's still tricky to really tease out without that real context of just how much that style's changed. And I actually went to a thing this week, an event essentially with Steve Parrish, the chairman of Crystal Palace, and he was doing a talk with Zoe Ward, who's the executive director at Norwich City, and they spoke about the process and the outcome. So if you were to just look solely at the outcome, you might not see too much of a real difference between Crystal Palace in terms of maybe points haul and positioning the table to a certain extent. This season compared with last season, but the style, as I say, has completely changed. So Crystal Palace have got so much more of the ball now. They're so much more possession. They're not too possession dominant game to game, but far more possession dominant than they were. And Steve Parrish said, he said, I realise that, you know, if you have more of the ball, the opposition is less likely to score a goal. And obviously sort of got a bit of a laugh for everyone. But so Palace have essentially gone from having the third lowest possession last season, 40%, to now the 10th highest possession in the league, 51%. So their style, they're far more ball playing, as I say. And I actually looked at the number of occasions that they have a possession sequence of 9 or more passes per 90 minutes. And last season it was around 13 per 90 minutes. And this season it's as high as 18. So 5 more occasions per game where they're having quite a long sequence of play, which is a massive difference. So as I say, aside from the points, there's been a real difference in the style. Rather than just a kind of let's just stay up maybe approach under Roy Hodgson, it's far more let's try and be progressive and try and take the game to the opposition with the exciting players that they have.
Yeah, they've done much better than I expected. The stylistic change has been incredible. Just even in terms of the basic possession numbers, their average possession has jumped. Last season was 41%, and this season is 53%. I can't imagine there's been that many examples of teams improving by that much from one season to the next. Maybe Stoke from Pulis to Mark Hughes, but I can't think there's been that many successful implementations of it. He's done a really good job, Vieira. I mean, I think it's funny when you look at Palace's squad. I mean, they've got a lot of really good players. Just in terms of their attacking options, Zaha, Ayew, Edouard, Mateta, Benteke, Olise, Eze, Schlupp, and that's not even including Conor Gallagher, who's probably been the biggest attacking force this season. But the thing I've been impressed by is that I think he's brought players on and he's improved players. I think Tyrick Mitchell at left back's had a really good campaign. Someone like Jeffrey Schlupp is just quite a useful player that he's managed to use in various different positions. Even Nathaniel Klein, who almost went off the radar for a couple of years, has come back and at times played a steady role at right back as well. And I think that, as much as the form of, you know, some of the very talented young players, makes me think that, yeah, Vieira is a good manager and is getting the most out of this squad.
Manager of the season material?
I personally wouldn't quite have him up there. I think he's done a really good job. But yeah, just in terms of the... I mean, maybe I'm contradicting what Steve Parish says about the points difference and that kind of thing. I just think manager of the season, you're looking for something really spectacular. And I think Vieira's done a very good job rather than a spectacular job.
Yeah, I agree. I think he may be worthy of a conversation next season if they push on. And the reason I say that is that I spoke to John Muller this week, our analytics writer, and he said about how when Vieira was at New York City, in the first season that he was there, it was all about kind of changing the style, and they weren't too good in the season before. And he did okay having changed the style. And then it was the subsequent couple of seasons that they really pushed on and implemented that. And having changed the style actually really pushed on in terms of points and performances on a consistent basis. So I think it will be really interesting to see now that he's started to implement this different style, just how much they can evolve, you know, from a points perspective next season.
Let's take a look at some of the other managers in the league. We won't touch on all of them in depth. Chelsea's Thomas Tuchel, they're going to finish third most likely. This is obviously a Premier League specific award. Michael, you mentioned last week your belief that Tuchel, ever since realising that City and Liverpool were pulling clear, has been focusing on the cup competitions. Of course, decent performance in the Champions League and two domestic cup final defeats on penalties as well. But their Premier League performance, Chelsea, in finishing third or fourth is probably about par. When it comes to the teams in fourth and fifth at the moment, Spurs and Arsenal, Antonio Conte and Mikel Arteta, neither realistically likely to be up for manager of the season, but it doesn't mean we can't pit them against each other for a bit of harmless fun on the pod. I'm sure it'll be taken in that nature as well. Arteta versus Conte then. Conte, who took over from Nuno at the start of November. Which North London boss, Michael, do you think has had a more impressive season?
I don't know. It's a difficult question to answer, isn't it? Because they've done such different jobs. Arteta's really building a young squad from scratch and trying to turn them into contenders, I suppose. And Conte was, you know, I think a squad with a lot of talented players who were massively underperforming. I don't know. I think I might just about give it to Arteta, because just when you look at the side that Arsenal played on Monday and you see the likes of, with respect, Tavares and Nketiah and Elneny, and you think, actually, to get this side to even vaguely close to fourth position is pretty impressive. But there's no, I mean, for me, there's no question. Conte, in my opinion, overall is a manager as good as pretty much anyone in the league. And I think with a full season at Tottenham, I think they could really, yeah, maybe even challenge next season.
Well, since he took charge, they've picked up four more points than Arsenal in that time. They've scored 11 goals more and conceded 10 fewer. So 21 goal swing in favour of Spurs, as well as 4 points. So that squad strength point, Mark, I'm sure there'll be plenty that disagree with that. From your perspective?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you've read out the numbers perfectly there, because I had some prep. But I looked at the underlying numbers a little bit more closely, and Spurs have, obviously, since Conte came in, Spurs have a better expected goals per game than Arsenal in the same period. Just they're generating chances worthy of 2 goals per game, Spurs, which is the third highest. And at the other end, Spurs have the fourth best defensive numbers. So they're conceding chances worthy of 1.1 goals per game, whereas Arsenal are just a little bit higher in terms of the chance they're conceding, 1.3 per game. So that's the seventh best in that period. But I think, so I just a note on Antonio Conte as well. I did a piece going back a few weeks ago now with Charlie Eccleshare, our Tottenham writer, and looked at the kind of the difference between Antonio Conte and Jose Mourinho at Spurs. And we sort of concluded that there wasn't a huge change necessarily in the style. It wasn't like maybe the Hodgson versus Vieira sudden change and shift, but it was sort of the application of it that was far better under Conte. So they were still using sort of counter-attacking play, but it was just with far more efficiency. So where they were previously kind of reaching the final third under Mourinho with counter-attacking play, they maybe weren't necessarily turning that into shots, whereas they just seem so sharp when they're actually, obviously they've got high quality players, but they just seem to be so much more clear in their idea of what they're doing when they reach those sort of final stages of the pitch. And I think that's testament to Conte as well.
Manchester United in sixth. Their two managers this season, Solskjaer and Ranić, I think neither really eligible or arguably worthy. But what about the team in seventh, West Ham, and their manager, David Moyes? Michael, might he feel most hard done by not to have made the shortlist? The Hammers are likely to finish one place beneath last year's highly impressive sixth place finish, and that's with the rigours of Europa League action as well.
Yeah, I almost think this is what I call the Alan Kirbishley effect, where a manager does a good job in making a team punch above their weight. And then when they sustain that, people just think that's their normal level. And they, you know, people forget that probably we wouldn't be surprised if they finish mid-table or bottom half. Yeah, I think he's done a really good job. And the Europa campaign didn't affect them too much. I think it probably did in the back end of the season. But they were fourth in mid-January. Which, when you've got to, you know, when they played six Europa League games, I think was really impressive. And of course, yeah, the run to the semi-finals and a fairly near miss in the Europa League, I think was just a massive thing for West Ham after the problems they've had in recent years. It's everything about the club feels different. Even the ground feels different. You know, it feels like there's an atmosphere there. There's a sense of purpose and belonging and all those things that I think Moyes actually did at Everton very well. So, yeah, maybe he should be on the shortlist. I think you're right. But with Moyes, I think people tend to almost take his quality for granted.
A victim of his own success and high standards, perhaps. Well, we've got one more part to come on the Athletic Football Tactics podcast. I'll be asking these guys if underlying performance metrics should come into judging managerial performance for an award like this, and also see if there's been any value in the many managerial sackings in this year's relegation battle. Stay with us.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Don't just ride the index, seek to outperform it with Fidelity Active ETFs. Learn more at fidelity.com/active ETFs. Before investing in any exchange-traded fund, you should consider its investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Contact Fidelity for a prospectus, an offering circular, or if available, a summary prospectus containing this information. Read it carefully. While active ETFs offer the potential to outperform an index, these products may more significantly trail an index as compared with passive ETFs. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC, member NYSE, SIPC.
So we got Leicester's Brendan Rodgers. I think Leicester's own high standards in the last, 8 years really means that ninth, it isn't really considered anything above average for them. And then there's a big chunk of teams from Wolves in eighth down to Aston Villa in 14th, with only 7 points between the seven teams. Just a couple of questions I had for you guys from this chunk. One of them is about Wolves and Bruno Lage. I feel like even Wolves fans are finding it quite hard to work out whether the club's performances this season have been great, good, or just about average. The fact is, Michael, they have leapt up 4 or 5 places, though.
Yes, yeah, funny one. I mean, the first two seasons they came up and they finished 7th and 7th. And then last year they had that really bad injury to Jimenez early doors. And I think that was probably the most, you know, a very serious injury. And I think people were almost pleased that it wasn't more serious than it could have been. But actually, it was the most damaging injury that any Premier League club suffered last year. So they dropped to 13th. And now he's back. He's been all right. They've made a couple of additions. And they're pretty much back to the level that they were before. So I think he's broadly done a good job. But I think there is a question mark about how much you credit the manager when the best player by far has been the goalkeeper.
Well, that's the big question, isn't it? How much should underlying performance numbers come into adding some more context to pure league position? For example, and this wasn't initially specific to Wolves, but there is a good parallel here. If you have finished 5 places higher than the season before in a very tight league with very few points between clubs, and it's mainly, shall we say, down to an amazing overperformance from your goalkeeper or maybe a striker who has hugely overperformed their expected goals numbers. How much should that come into it? Michael, would you accept the use of underlying performance metrics in this instance?
Yeah, I think so. I think, broadly speaking, I think the managers can take responsibility for the XG performance. But there's going to be factors like goalkeeping and finishing that are broadly beyond their influence. So yeah, I absolutely think those stats can be considered. Again, probably wouldn't read them out in front of the managers themselves at the ceremony and explain why I was overlooking one of the big managers and giving it to Thomas Frank or whatever. But yeah, I certainly think they're the kind of numbers that, in a way, we've always considered. Do you know what I mean? They've just been quantified now. But that's the thing with expected goals. People have always talked about whether teams deserve to win games and that kind of thing. So, yeah, I think they should be considered.
When we're talking about manager of the season as well, I do understand that the outcome is ultimately what decides a team's position in the table. And that will obviously then decide whether they get into Europe or whether they win the league or whether they do or don't get relegated. So I think that obviously has a heavy skew, but I definitely think that you should maybe look at the underlying. I mean, I would say that, wouldn't I, that you should look at the underlying numbers. But I mean, you think of Graham Potter at Brighton. He's the style of play that he's implemented is actually, you know, so clear. But sometimes the quality of the performance at both ends, right when it really matters, you know, obviously finishing and conceding has just maybe gone against them sometimes. But there's only so much that a manager can do. They can't actually be the ones to kick the ball in the back of the net or, you know, save a goal as well. So I think it shows just how much the intention of the manager over and above the individual performances has had an influence rather than it just being, a player having a purple patch at either a striker or a goalkeeper.
I would happily chat to Bruno Lage at an awards do about his goalkeeper, José Sá, and in particular, his shot-stopping performance this season. Now, we know there's a lot more that goes into goalkeeping performance and a goalkeeper's quality than just shot-stopping. But per Opta Analyst and their goals prevented metric, José Sá has prevented 9 goals more than an average goalkeeper would have been expected to prevent based on the shots that he has faced this season, which for a team that's won 11 of their 15 wins by a single goal feels pretty significant and sit atop a chunk of teams, as I said, separated by just 7 points, 7 teams in that chunk. Now, I asked the excellent Opta Analyst if this was the best goalkeeper performance in terms of goals prevented in their records. It's not. The best performance that they have recorded was in 2012-13, and it was Simon Mignolet, who prevented 15.7 goals above average as per their, or above expected as per that metric. The second best performance on record, David De Gea's superhuman 2017-18 season with 13.7 prevented. You're looking quizzical there, Michael.
Was that Mignolet's first season at Liverpool?
It was his last season at Sunderland, I think, because I think Liverpool signed him 13-14.
Was it just when the Liverpool invested a lot in laptop types, I think?
Yeah. I mean, I've got no recollection of him ever being that good. That's remarkable. That's shocked me more than the Tony Pulis thing.
A great pod for narratives surrounding Simon Mignolet and Tony Pulis and our recollection of them and their performances. Now, the reverse of this discussion, Mark, inevitably the other side of the coin, Brighton and Hove Albion and Graham Potter in this chunk of teams still underperforming their XG in front of goal and likely to finish between 9th and 13th in that chunk.
There's only so much the manager can do. And, you know, we spoke about Vieira as well, implementing such a clear playing style. It makes you think that, and if we're thinking about the value of Graham Potter, if he were to have maybe higher quality players, and that's no disrespect to the players he has at Brighton, but players who could finish those chances that as a team he has built to make sure that they do create these high quality chances, makes you think that the value of Graham Potter maybe would increase if he were to be at a top six side, shall we say. But I think it sort of speaks to a wider point, which I find really interesting, on the impact of a manager. I know that John Muller, shortly after he arrived at The Athletic, did a really interesting piece on Ole Gunnar Solskjaer when he was sacked as Manchester United manager, and essentially just showing that there's a really strong correlation between the value of a squad and their overall points haul. So basically saying, do United even need a manager because they, you know, they spend so much on their players anyway. So I think where we can really tease out the utility of a manager over and above just what the quality of the squad actually is sort of, yeah, people like Graham Potter who are extracting, and Thomas Frank, of course, as well, extracting real value out of their players over and above what is actually maybe their individual value.
But how can we measure a manager's DNA and how much they just get it? That's maybe something for you to look into this summer, Mark, when things quieten down a bit. Okay, the bottom five clubs in the Premier League have all sacked managers during this campaign. Everton went from Benitez to Lampard, Leeds, Bielsa to Marsh, Burnley, Dyche to the interim Jackson, Watford from Cisco Munoz to Claudio Ranieri to Roy Hodgson, who's already left but still confusingly in the dugout, and Norwich from Daniel Farke to Dean Smith. Michael, have any of these clubs benefited from their mid-season managerial change?
I think Burnley have. I think that's been a real change. Most people thought that Dyche was, you know, it was crazy to sack him. And since he's gone, I mean, they've got three wins, which was more than I would have expected in those six games. I think they've played a slightly more positive style of football. Defending has broadly been good, with the exception of the game against Villa, when actually they were very bad, really open between the lines. But yeah, I think you have to give Jackson credit. I think that has worked out reasonably well. And I think, are they going to stay up? We're recording this on Wednesday afternoon. I think they're just about going to stay up. And if they do, I think you have to say that's gone very well. Leeds, I think, had to gamble. I think Bielsa, I think that was at an end. I'm not sure they've got any better, but I don't think it's necessarily, well, I don't think it was a bad move. And even Everton, maybe, I mean, I've got reservations about Lampard and the job he's been doing. But again, I think not just a tactical thing, but the fans really weren't having Benitez. And I think Lampard has at least given them some kind of fighting spirit, which I didn't really suspect they had under the previous manager. So I think a few have been okay.
I mean, yeah, the numbers back up exactly what you said, Michael. I basically looked at the points per game of each of the respective managers. And of course, there's the caveat that they've had different number of games played. I mean, as you say, Jackson only been in the dugout for six of those games. But if we kind of go through it one by one, that Everton, their points per game under Benitez was one. Under Lampard, it's 1.1, so marginally better, if you like. Leeds, Bielsa, it was 0.9 points per game. Marsh, 1.1, so again, a marginal improvement. The biggest one is obviously Burnley, small number of games, but Dyche, it was 0.8 points per game. Jackson, 1.7. So, you know, whether or not if he had more time, that would maybe level out a little bit, I don't know. Watford, always a fun one to include three managers within the season, but Munoz, one, Ranieri and Hodgson, both 0.5 points per game. So I still found it quite strange that they sacked him so soon anyway in terms of Munoz. And Norwich, Daniel Farke, 0.5 points per game, Dean Smith, 0.7. So each one has been overall with enough games, obviously aside from Jackson, just a little bit better. So it's maybe a slight improvement in the first few games, a bit of a bounce, but ultimately not too much of an improvement.
So the only one that's being held up as definitively improvement is also impossible to say at this point whether there's anything to it other than the initial bounce, as it's often called. I just find that really fascinating. I mean, we had a situation in England's fourth tier in League Two this season where obviously no one wants to be relegated from any league, but particularly out of the fourth tier into non-league. And there were maybe eight very poor teams and they all just kept sacking a manager, in some cases two, really just to get the one or two or maybe three at a push wins to lift them out of what was a terrible little squabble down at the bottom of League Two. And almost all of them did get one or two wins at the point of sacking their manager, and almost all of them ended up regressing back to as bad as they were beforehand. So it was like a game of musical chairs. You know, you've got one weapon in this fight and it's the managerial bounce. When do you deploy it? How late in the season do you leave it? It was kind of fascinating to watch. It kind of feels, we haven't had it to the same extent here, but it kind of feels like a similar question. When do you deploy your managerial change to get realistically just a little bounce. I suppose, you know, we have spoken about Eddie Howe and the transformation that he's had. So I'm not saying that changing manager can't bring about a positive change, but sometimes there's more to it than just the managers. I think actually a new manager bounce episode could probably be in the pipeline. So we'll stick that on the docket, pop that in the chamber for a future episode. We'll leave you with our picks for manager of the year. It's what we've been discussing for 45 minutes or so. Mark Carey, going to come to you first. I know you like laying down the law with opinions and picks. Who would be your Premier League manager of the year?
I mean, you know, I take the emotion out of it. That's pretty much my job. So I'm not going to defer too much from what's happened for the past 7 years, I think you said. So I do think I will give it to Pep Guardiola on this occasion. But I do think that Thomas Frank is a very close second.
Michael, inject emotion right into it, please.
Well, yeah, I mean, for me, Guardiola would be up there. Frank would be very close. But partly because I think his team have got more points, have overperformed in terms of points by more than any other. And partly because he basically said I wasn't allowed to say he was manager of the year at the start of the podcast. I think I would go for Jurgen Klopp. I don't know how much consideration has to be taken in of the cup competitions. But they've won the League Cup, they've won the FA Cup, and they're favourites to win the Champions League final. And they're going to finish probably one point short in the Premier League. I think it's not far away from being the best season any club's ever had.
Any cup competition context is redacted and will be struck off from this podcast in this court. Shouldn't play at all into Premier League awards for me.
Okay, but even if I'm not considering the value of winning the trophies, the fact that they've played every game in the season, they've played, you know, and their Premier League performance hasn't suffered that much. They've gone the distance in the League Cup, the FA Cup, the Champions League. And it's not like they've run out of steam, really, in the league. I think you have to give a little bit of consideration to that personally.
Okay, well, you've made your case pretty clear. I'll pick Thomas Frank. Call me maybe a bit of EFL bias here, but the absolute admiration that I have for him and his management of that squad, that team, this year has been absolutely fantastic. I can't wait to see what happens next season. And also, so that I can tell you a story that I hope you guys don't know already, Michael had already got my quiz question ready himself. But what about the story about Thomas Frank at Brøndby, where upon his departure, it became clear that the major shareholder of Brøndby, Jans Beck Andersen, had been criticising him on the fan forum, Sid Seiden Online, under a pseudonym, using his son's account, very much got found out, and that didn't look great, did it? So Thomas Frank's done very well to bounce back. I don't imagine anyone from the Brentford hierarchy will be criticising him under a pseudonym on any Brentford forums. I do like the idea for you guys that some of your senior editors might be in the comments section under a pseudonym, just trying to plant ideas in your head subliminally, or trying to get you to stop writing articles about Eurovision and snooker, for God's sake. Anyway, that's what you can read on theathletic.com at the moment. You can sign up at theathletic.com/tactics. You'll pay just £1 a month for the first 6 months for everything that Michael and Mark are contributing, and so much more on site as well. Football-related, American sports, etc. Would implore you to do that today. And make sure you subscribe to this podcast feed so that you can hear our final episode of the season, which will go out next week, a Champions League final preview. Join us then. And thank you for listening to The Athletic Football. Football Tactics Podcast.
The Athletic.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.